I'm Aislinn Antrim with Pharmacy Times, and welcome back to a special limited series from the Pharmacy Focus podcast, delving into the new frontier of anti-obesity medications and treatments. In the last episode, we spoke with physician Donna Ryan for an overview of these new anti-obesity medications, how they could be revolutionary to treat obesity, and how clinicians must balance the risks of obesity with patients' desire to be accepted. In January, the American Academy of Pediatrics published clinical practice guidelines for the evaluation and treatment of children and adolescents with obesity. Notably, the evidence-based interventions include motivational interviewing, intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatments, pharmacotherapy, and, in some cases, metabolic or bariatric surgery. Jennifer Salvin, our guest this episode, is a clinical pharmacist and an adjunct professor at the University of Connecticut School of Pharmacy in Storrs. In a conversation with associate editor Ashley Gallagher, Salvin discussed the guidelines as well as concerns about disordered eating and celebrities and pop culture influences on weight loss. What is motivational interviewing and how has it been used successfully? And what could some of the drawbacks be?
You know, motivational interviewing is really, it's a counseling method. It's an approach where it's an individual approach where you're trying to help the individual gain confidence and to see the behavior changes that might be necessary to turn a disease state around. It's been used in, cancer. It's been used in obesity, of adults. It's been used in smoking cessation, sometimes used in medication adherence. You know, people that are really terrible at taking their meds, you know. I kind of like it because, you know, a lot of people have insecurities about different things. And it kind of approaches the whole person and not just telling them what they have to do, but helping them gain the knowledge and the confidence to do what they really need to do. Some drawbacks, it takes time. It's not something that you can do a one and done. It's not like they come in and you counsel them how to use their inhaler and they go home. You know, it takes someone trained in asking open-ended questions, in being, when they hit resistance or meet resistance, being calm and not getting defensive and starting arguments. You really gotta be patient and kind of work your way around some of the resistance that you're going to meet in some ways. It's most useful in people that are unmotivated and don't know exactly what to do. People who are motivated know what to do. I think it doesn't work as well in them. Well, because they're already motivated. So they're already on the path to take care of what they need to do. I don't think people are aware. I'm not sure if even all practitioners are aware. You know, one thing about a new guideline coming out is I know it takes up to 7 years for adoption of the guideline by practitioners. And I think that any education like what you're doing to get it out there is going to be helpful. One of the reasons we did the needs assessment with UConn is because we felt like pharmacists needed to know more. I mean, pharmacists are on the front line. They see obese patients all the time. They come up and check out their meds with a sleeve of donuts and, you know, a bunch of soda. And it's just to have them aware and even know how to approach the patient, I think is very important, because it is definitely multifactorial. It can't just be a pediatrician or even if they're adults, just telling the patient what to do or telling them they need to go to counseling. The other thing was insurance coverage. You know, if patients have to pay out of pocket for this, they're not going to do it. You know, lots of times, the socioeconomic status of patients that are obese can be on the lower scale, and that's tough as well. So you've got to be cognizant of that. That's one of the reasons I like I am, you'll find as we talk, a total body approach person. I really like, I believe in functional medicine to a certain extent and getting to the root cause of things, which is one of the reasons why it's exciting some of the new meds that are coming out for obesity, because there are cases where the patient could exercise and eat all they want and it wouldn't help. So I do think you need to come at it from all angles, but motivational interviewing, I think, is key in a lot.
Will this help to combat some of the mental health aspects of obesity by finding and implementing more obtainable goals other than just weight loss?
Yeah, I think the whole individual approach, and, you know, I was reading that these programs are, you know, it's over like 26 hours over 3 to 12 months. So it's meant to be there to support you, you know, give you the education, but also support the patient. And it could be, you know, thinking of my daughter works in the Bronx. She's a teacher and these kids just go home. There's no way to have physical activity. So what are little things you can do? Well, take the stairs, walk to the bus stop, walk to a further bus stop. You know, it needs to be individual and it can't just be you need more physical activity. Well, how can you help this person identify areas where they could be physical, you know, or, you know, you're on your way home and you're stopping at the store. So I'm going to get that sugary, you know, soda instead. You know, maybe you get one of those vitamin waters that's got, you know, lower, you know, still tastes good. You still have something that feels like a treat, you know, so I think it just needs to be individual. Identifying the triggers for people too is going to be helpful. One thought I had that I like is supporting the patient to believe they can do it if they failed in the past. You know, just because you've tried this before and it hasn't worked or you tried it successfully and backslid, you know, I think the motivational interviewing helps with those patients as well. It's not just a first time patient. It's patients that may have had experience with this in the past. So that's one thing I like. And it's expressing empathy and realizing, you know, it's like, I do think the world is shifting a little bit into, oh, you're overeating. That's the problem. It's not the problem. You know, there's a lot of different factors here. Sure, maybe you are overeating, but what's causing that overeating or what's causing you to keep the weight on or, you know, not be able to get out there and exercise? So.
Can you explain the benefits of intensive health behavioral and lifestyle programs?
Well, those are programs that, I believe they have a little bit of a team approach, but I know that their goal is to involve the whole family, and that's what I like for the pediatric obesity. I think the whole family has to be invested. You know, when we talk a little later or at some point, I have some concerns about this guideline, definitely, and just where it could go. You know, there's avenues where this could go really wrong for some patients as well. But I do like that it's family-based. The focus is on, you know, my understanding is the focus is not on your BMI or your weight. Granted, those are goals, but it's more like we talked about, lifestyle changes. Like how can you, you know, where can you find those avenues to change what's going on? And I do like and think that this approach helps because it's consistent over time. You know, we all know to start a habit, it's not going to happen today or tomorrow. And half the time when you make a New Year's resolution, 1 week later, you're done because you haven't had enough time to make it a habit. You know, the guidelines are for ages 2 and up, which it blows my mind that we could identify a baby as obese at 2 because they all should have baby fat for a while. I mean, granted, there's the ones that are way, but those are the ones that probably have diabetes, you know, already, or they have a hereditary issue, you know. You know, it's kind of hard. I think school-aged children and up, definitely teens. But at that point, you may have lost them a little bit. So my opinion is that it would be school-aged and up. And part of that is also the choices of food in the school. There's so many children in our country that go to school for the food because they have food insecurity. And so that's one of the society issues that I believe in, that we could, you know, and I know Michelle Obama tried to do it, we could have healthier choices in the school systems. You know, you go in and you're handed macaroni and cheese and mashed potatoes with gravy and, you know, full fat milk. Not that that's that terrible, but I also think that dairy can be an issue with some kids too, so.
What is the impact of these, and does it compare to the interventions of disordered eating? Is there potential for these interventions to have a reverse effect in which some children might become too self-aware of their nutritional patterns and weight so that they turn towards disordered eating?
Similar, and it's interesting to see the development of disordered eating versus eating disorders. You know, eating disorder, I think pretty much half of everyone has to have a disordered eating in a way, because we all like what we want to eat and want to look a certain way, perhaps, you know, and, but I do think they're similar. I think it is similar. I think disordered eating might, focus a little bit more on the mental aspects. And that was one thing I really didn't see in the pediatric guideline. We're doing interventional, you know, motivated interviewing, but I didn't see a lot. And I'd have to, you know, it was a couple of months ago, but about like, what if a child is depressed? You know, that there is a chemical imbalance. There is, you know what I mean? So it's not, that could be part of it as well. So I really do. I think it's a fine balance that it would take a really skilled, interviewer, to fine tune to make sure they didn't. Because I think inside every, almost every, I shouldn't say every, in a lot of obese patients, there is that disordered eating anyway. And so they may become hyper aware of what they're eating. I mean, you know, we talk about childhood obesity, and it is a problem. You know, almost 20 million children are obese in the United States. But then there's also those kids that are hyper aware and not eating, or bulimic, or, you know what I mean? There's, so it's a whole, to me, it's a whole spectrum of eating disorders. Obesity definitely is something we need to pay attention to, because these kids are probably going to grow up and have issues, you know, real medical issues with type 1 diabetes and high cholesterol and hypertension and, you know, even arthritis, you know, because they're overweight, carrying things around, you know, carrying around extra weight, you know, which isn't always good for the body. I do think they can become too self-aware. I think they're already too self-aware. We'll get to the social media part.
What are the various limitations of these interventions?
Pretty much the same. It's the time commitment. You know, a lot of people, and it doesn't even matter your social economic status. I mean, even, you know, with my husband, we didn't have a lot of time when the kids were younger. But anyone, if you're a working parent, do you have time to do this? You know, did your kid have time? Because depending on what they're doing, and this is where I get into a whole discussion with my daughter about homework. You know, you just went to school for 6 or 7 hours. You want them to be active, but you're going to give them 3 or 4 hours of homework to do, but they need to eat right and get some sleep. And it just, you know, that's a part of the whole society thing that I think needs to maybe be tweaked a little bit. But, you know, insurance coverage, cultural barriers too. You know, there's some cultural and heritage areas, you know, where someone wouldn't be open to this. And how do you, you know, hopefully steer them towards it or overcome that barrier? Language barrier. You know, I don't know off the top of my head how many motivational interviews there are, or IHBLT therapists, you know. So I think that could be, I mean, with, you know, there's a lot of, because we run into a lot at the hospital, there's online interpreters now. You know, I think the pandemic in one way was good with this Zooming to meet and, you know, having access to more online support.
Have you listened to other podcasts from Pharmacy Focus? We have podcasts for all interests, from students to psychedelics. In the latest episode of Pharmacy Focus, Psychedelic Pharmacy, we spoke with David Keene, Vice President of Digital Therapeutics at Atai Life Sciences, to learn about digital therapeutics and their use in psychedelic medicine. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts. How will social determinants of health and lack of care access contribute to the effectiveness of IHBLT? Will this make it a realistic choice for families and their children?
Yeah, I actually, like I said, I think it's individual. If a child is trending towards overweight, and, you know, I just, like, we have neighbors, and, you know, a girl is, you know, a sophomore, and she's overweight, but she is active in sports. You know, they watch what they eat, mostly, you know, but they're also teenagers. They're gonna go for things that aren't. I would like to see it before a lot of the other things that are proposed in the guideline, because I'm not a fan of, at least I'm a little afraid that with the guidelines promoting bariatric surgery that parents might reach for it as a quick fix. I think society and, you know, we talk about the effects of social media. We're looking for quick fixes. I mean, you know, when you have bariatric surgery, you're reducing your stomach to the size of this. You know, and you're going to be hungry. You're going to have side. It's going to take 6 months for your body to really adjust and for your stomach to, you know, become what it's going to be, which is still only going to be about a cup, maybe a little more. And that, and if you don't follow it, it could have, you know, if you burst, you could do, there's a lot of different repercussions there. So I get worried about the surgery in terms of follow up and compliance. I get worried that parents may want to do it quickly because they just want their kid to fit in or be thin without, you know, having to go through a lot of the other, you know, it takes time and effort. And I think sometimes people, like our society, is looking for a quick fix. I would worry about, you know, because you aren't going to absorb as many vitamins and minerals. It's very important to get your protein in. And I don't think that we have enough protein in general. So I would be worried doing it too young. You know, by the time you're 16 or so, I think most people are, you know, and that's just my opinion. You know, someone maybe a little more experienced or more of an expert in the field would have a different opinion. But my opinion is, you know, I really think that we could do it too young. 12 years old is too young. We're a pill-popping society. And one of the things that, you know, people that know me laugh about when I get going, I am a minimalist. I would prefer to review someone's profile and get them off meds. Because sometimes I think we just add. And I think that behavioral changes and lifestyle changes could do a lot for our society. Do I think that, where we go? Is it realistic? I'm not sure it's 100% realistic. And I think that just has to do with what we talked about before. It's the time commitment, but you have to put the time commitment in. I think as this gains traction and hopefully this part of the guideline is, adopted, that there'll be more, like I think people in more of an urban area are going to have access to some of these programs, but someone in suburbia or in rural, they're not going to have access to it. And then that becomes a whole other thing. Are you going to drive 45 minutes to do this? And I don't think, you know, you have to go somewhere. I don't believe they go to your house to do this. So I think this is something you've got to, you know, go to. I don't know. First thing I should look up is if, and I'm sure no one studied it, but how effective is this face-to-face versus over Zoom, which would be convenient? You know, everyone went to televisits for a couple of years, and a lot of people still like to do the televisits. So, you know, that could be something that's developed and studied in the future. It could be the way to go because that you probably get access to more people. A lot of people have access to the Internet. I know there's plenty that my daughter teaches that don't necessarily have access to it. They have their phone. But there is that access, so...
Do you have an opinion on the best intervention for children and their parents to take?
I mean, you asked something in there, and I said, quite simply, the one that works. I don't think there's something, a one-size-fits-all, which is, I think, what this guideline, you know, I'm for it and not for it. I think it's bringing attention to something that needs to have attention. But I don't think a guideline, you know, to be a guideline, you have to have some, you know, parameters on it. So I just think the one that works, you know, motivational interviewing isn't going to work for everyone. There could be, you know, someone, you know, like, and we haven't even talked about the drugs. I don't think that was on our radar here necessarily, but, you know, they are finding, you know, discovering more and more about certain, you know, the GLP-1 inhibitor, you know, those different drugs that will help you on a more cellular level with things because some people really are storing fat. And part of that is a vicious cycle. The more you eat, the more it activates the system, and the less you eat, the more it's under control. But that's one of the problems with Ozempic, because it helps, but then you stop taking it and you gain weight back. I think there's definitely a risk in there. And anytime you're introducing anything different, and, you know, not that foods don't have certain risks depending on your genetic makeup, but they have less of a risk. It's much more natural to your body to go, you know, in the food and exercise, avenue. Some people do have to take meds, but there's always a risk. And, you know, metformin is one of the drugs they use, and that is a lot, you know, nausea, vomiting, you know, a lot of people don't tolerate that well. But even Ozempic has nausea, vomiting, you know, a lot of the GI upset. So I guess that's what I would say.
The guidelines from the American
I guess I said
Pediatric
the one that
Society.
Works, but I feel like most approaches should come from that, you know, lifestyle avenue first. And I'm just afraid too with the whole, you know, the, doctors have to see somebody in 15 or 20 minutes. How much motivational interviewing can they do? How much delving can they do? And just, you know what I mean? So I do think in some ways that needs to shift a little too. But the only way that'll shift is if, our payment plans, you know, shift as well.
The guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics support these treatments, and they say that they have proven to actually reduce disordered eating. However, there's also evidence that social media and celebrity influences increase disordered eating in children and adolescents. Do you believe that the popularity of anti-obesity medications such as Ozempic could have a negative effect on children's mental health?
Yes. Yes, I think, you know, it's... I think about this a lot just because, you know, you see it on social media. I'm not on TikTok, but I hear about it from others. And I, you know, I see it out there. And hearing it from my sister, who's got a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old, and she's like, she can't keep them off the screen. And it, there's just so many things out there that you worry about them being exposed to that people, you know, make look cool, you know, and, you know, like, oh, it's cool. Maybe I'll throw up after I ate, or, you know, and look at how I'm controlling my weight. The other side of the coin is, and I don't think it's a bad thing, but it can go both ways, is this embracing of large bodies. We should all love the body we have, but I also am afraid that people are going to feel like, well, I don't have to lose weight because look at, everybody thinks it's cool to be big too. You know what I mean? So I think social media definitely is going to promote disordered eating. Yeah. I think it already has.
Will the pop culture prevalence of these medications hinder the intended treatment? Will more young adults want to start taking Ozempic because they saw their favorite celebrity use it? And does this have the potential to increase disordered eating or body image concerns?
There was an article about Kim Kardashian. It was Kim Kardashian, I think, that took it and lost a bunch of weight to fit into Marilyn Monroe's dress. I think that was not a good, you know, that's not good for young kids to see. And, you know, you would say school age, but I, you know, it's amazing to me, like middle schoolers have phones now and they're all over it. And I almost think that they may even be more susceptible than teenagers. I think almost not, I think they're already there at teenagers, unfortunately, but they're also looking at it too. Yeah. I definitely think the pop culture is affecting the use of these medications and the proper use. I also, you know, it's just all over, you know, like, cause I think even some parents might see it and think, oh, this could be good for my kid. You know, nothing else is working. Let's try this. I totally believe that we're going to see more disordered eating and body issues just between. And I think with the guideline, one of the things I'm worried about is, like I said, it takes about 7 years for, you know, healthcare professionals to really adopt it. But I also think that this guideline is over 100 pages long. And I think to really understand it, they did put out an executive summary as well, but I think people are going to focus on the medication and surgery, and they'll look at the motivational interviewing as maybe an option, but it takes time. And like I said, we're all looking for a quick fix. Our society's looking for a quick fix. So I think, you know, the eating's going to increase. I think the body image. One of the things I think is I don't think we realized the extent of disordered eating and body images previously. So I'm not sure that it's going to skyrocket. It may look like it's skyrocketing, but I think it's just coming more to the forefront as well.
Thanks for listening. Tune back in on September 27th for the final installment of this limited series.